In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
We have this notion promoted by societal forces that both science and doctors are somehow infallible. But if you talk to honest doctors, they will tell you that we have barely scratched the surface of medical knowledge, that much of what they do is an educated guess, at best. That's why everything must be questioned. Science is not a religion with an omnipotent, omniscient God at the head of it, dispensing perfect knowledge. And doctors or other scientists are neither archbishops nor saints. You know, there is nothing a bureaucracy hates more than to be proven wrong, especially when they make a prediction. You see it in global warming, where they are actively cheering for hotter weather, claiming every year is the hottest year on record, except they jimmy the numbers to get there. With COVID, we know they jimmied the numbers, and now it's practically beginning to look like governments are wanting more people to die to fit their early models that predicted far, far more deaths than we've had. Here's the reality. A naturally acquired immunity is far, far superior to the vaccine. It is robust, it is durable, and cannot be improved on. This is an established fact. So why is the government mandating you accept an inferior product for a disease with an average 99.8% or higher recovery rate? Worse, it's a vaccine with known side effects. A doctor in Idaho has seen a 20-fold increase of cancer in his lab this year. Why push this on people? Why make it the condition upon which you are allowed to participate in society? The other reality is there are better medicines available right now than the vaccines. You might remember a few months ago, there was a surge of COVID cases in India. The World Health Organization, the CDC, and the media all hyperventilated about the vaccine, the vaccine. They need the vaccine. The vaccine will save them. But India didn't listen. Instead, they gave out ivermectin. You know, the same drug that the World Health Organization, the CDC, and the media are all hyperventilating about now. Cases plummeted, dropping from some 311,000 in April to 269. Not 269,000, 269. So here's a question I want you to have running around your head as you listen to today's show. Why is it wrong when you lie to the government, but it's perfectly okay when the government lies to you? You get more freedom by standing up to tyranny, not by submitting to it. America was founded on rebelling. We didn't get to be free because we obeyed the king. And somehow we've gotten to the point that you must obey the government at all costs. The cost of your job, your religion, your freedom of speech, your American soul. And people think this is going to get you more freedom? This is the beginning of the loss of your freedom, not the end. No society in the history of man has obeyed its way to more freedom. I'd like to welcome back Senator Dennis Lithcomb. He represents Senate District 28. That's down in the Klamath Falls area, and he's also the treasurer of the Oregon Republican Party. Dennis, it's only been a week, but good to talk to you again.
You bet. It's always fun to get together, and it seems like we've got a lot to talk about, so I'm glad we get the chance.
Yeah, there just seems to be never enough time, and in fact, you really surprised us last week when you just sort of casually said that you and Senator Kim Thatcher were calling for a grand jury to investigate the government and its COVID numbers. So lots to unpack here, but let's actually start with the general concept of a grand jury, and then we'll talk about yours specifically in the next segment. So talk to us about the process you're going through to form a grand jury.
Well, the grand juries actually exist across the many districts in the United States. We submitted our investigative request to the grand jury, the attorney for the United States of America in Medford. And that grand jury attorney is essentially a prosecutor, and his reason for existence isn't to determine, you know, or accuse or investigate anything. His responsibility is to look for probable cause, i.e. he's wondering, based on the evidence that we provided, if it's believable that one or more persons might have committed certain federal offenses within the venue of his district court. And so that is our claim. Our claim is that the CDC, the FDA, the NVSS, which stands for the National Vital Statistics System.
So what, if any, legal authority does such a grand jury have? I mean, can they actually prosecute people, or is it just to open a prosecution? What does that process look like?
Okay, so the process, we submit a request to the U.S. attorney, and that attorney then calls together 12 jurors, and those jurors are, quote, the grand jury. And the grand jury is are the individuals who go through the data, through the accusations, through our case law, and determine if it's appropriate to make a indictment. And so you remember, all the way back to the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, no person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless a presentment or an indictment of a grand jury. And then, you know, it goes on and on there. The Fifth Amendment is fairly long amendment. But the point is, the grand jury is the key factor for determining probable cause for criminal activity.
So how are those members of that grand jury selected? Does he just randomly choose them from voters, or is there some sort of legal qualifications they have to have? Because I just happen to know a couple of people who'd love to be on it.
Yeah, you make a great point. The grand jury is an already pre-selected pool. So the grand jury exists. And the pool of individuals exists, and we submitted our request to the attorney's office. He will review it and submit it to the grand jury for further investigation. And how that actually happens is a little bit fuzzy to all of us. We've raised follow-up questions. When will this be before the grand jury? Jury, have you submitted yet? Have they read the details? We sent in a very large packet, and we're right now we're kind of waiting as the slow steamroller of government churns along, looking for criminal activity.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we'll dig into the specifics of their grand jury. We'll do that with Senator Dennis Lithcomb. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking to Senator Dennis Lithcomb. Well, they just have called for a grand jury investigation into the COVID numbers. And I want to dig a little bit more into your investigation here. In terms of, now that you've called for this grand jury, is he obligated to now impanel this, or can he reject it? What's the process here going forward?
You're asking really good questions, and it's hard to get a lead on that because different district offices manage their grand jury setup in different ways. So we used counsel to kind of advise us on what to submit to the grand jury, and we supplied case law references for them to understand the importance of actually submitting this investigative request to the grand jury. And now we're kind of waiting to see if they need more data or interested in more details or information before they actually go ahead with it or whatnot. It's a very lengthy process in terms of getting in front of the grand jury, but our allegations are strong. We've got a great data packet. The information actually shows up in a document that people can find online. It's called COVID-19 Comorbidity and Federal Law, and it was published October 12th of 2020. And it's a peer-reviewed published paper COVID-19 comorbidity and federal law, October 12, 2020. And in there, you can see the allegations that we used for our grand jury request.
Okay. We'll make sure that we can put that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And there are some other supporting documents within the press release about this. And in terms of where you're at now, have you just submitted the letter or application? Did you actually speak with the U.S. Attorney General, or is it just in the very early stages here and you don't actually talk to him later, until later, I mean?
That's correct. We submitted via email, so it's, and we asked for a return receipt, and we know that they have it. They said it's in their desk. They're, you know, they've got maybe 1,000 other requests. They're going to have to prioritize their human resources, their time, and the capacity of the grand jury to investigate all of these things. And so I think the perfect opportunity for other judicial jurisdictions across, excuse me, across the United States to file grand jury petitions or requests,
yes,
within their own grand jury districts. It would be a great, use ours as a template and then do that in your own jurisdiction. Let your own representatives or senators or city council persons or whoever you think might be able to submit a grand jury and withstand the pressure from the industries that we think have been acting illegally.
Well, we certainly, from our perspective and everything that we've investigated, we would definitely support that. They have jimmied these numbers pretty much since the beginning. But in terms of your particular grand jury, and I know that Leah Wilson was involved in this, and she's been calling for grand jury. She's gotten tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of signatures to help support this. Is yours the very first grand jury to have been formally applied for?
Yes, it is. They've been making requests. We actually submitted requests to all the U.S. attorneys across the U.S. Kim Thatcher and I weren't a part of that, but the Dr. Henry Ely and his,
yes,
investigative team had submitted those grand jury requests to all grand juries in the United States. And none of those responded. So we decided, okay, this is just Joe Citizen making a request. Let's add some political weight to it. And Kim Thatcher and I stepped up to the plate.
Does that add any more likelihood that this will be impaneled then, with you guys being involved?
Right. That's the $64,000 question. And we do not know the answer to that. It seems to me that it would be inappropriate for our position to be the thing that that pushes this over the edge, because what we're supposed to have in the United States of America is every citizen is supposed to have these rights, and we're supposed to be viewed as equal under the law, and justice is supposed to be wearing a blindfold.
Right.
And so if Lady Justice has a blindfold, it's not our position, it's not our wealth, it's not our power, it's the fact that we're citizens of the United States of America and that this is an appropriate investigative performance obligation of the government for those in government who are acting inappropriately.
Well, I don't think that you had said that it was an inappropriate thing that you had to do this, but I wouldn't say inappropriate. I'd say more unfortunate, because you're right. Is this is something that should be open to every citizen? But on the other side of things, you know, don't cut yourself short on this. It's great that we have leaders like yourself stepping up to the plate, because clearly the system that's there is not working the way that it should be. We have people running from these responsibilities, and we know that they have jimmied the numbers. They have quietly changed those numbers and admitted that they've lied about these various numbers around COVID. But I think we'll come back to that in the next segment. In terms of this particular grand jury, who is this aimed at? Is it aimed at Oregon state officials, or is it higher up the food chain like the CDC and the NIH?
It's the fire up the food chain. This is federal law. Our accusations are federal law has been violated, in particular the Information Quality Act, the IQA, and the Paperwork Reduction Act, the PRA. The Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, has policy, quote, to provide, their requirement is, quote, to provide policy and procedural guidance to federal agencies for ensuring and maximizing the quality, objectivity, utility, and integrity of information disseminated by federal agencies. We're making the claim that they have done none of those things. In fact, they're violating quality and destroying objectivity and tainting information.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's our allegation.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Come back. We'll be looking more into this grand jury investigation with Senator Dennis Lithcomb. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Senator Dennis Lithcomb. He's out of the Southern District, Senate District of 28. That's down the Klamath Falls area. And he, along with Senator Kim Thatcher, have recently have applied for a grand jury investigation into some of these COVID numbers and malfeasance on the part of some of these agencies. And so, Dennis, as far as this grand jury is concerned, what's the outcome of this? And in a best case scenario, what do you hope to pry loose?
Well, what we allege is that there has been willful and wanton misconduct by these federal organizations, and we believe that they actually are aware of their misconduct and keep trying to bury their misconduct under other obfuscations. Look at the Paperwork Reduction Act and the Information Quality Act require that the CDC, in this case, a federal agency, provide adequate notice when initiating, substantially modifying, or terminating significant information that's within their domain. And one of the things they've done is they've changed the way death certificates are being filled out. So line one and line two of the death certificate is running under completely new rules, which is entirely untoward.
Yes. Well, and we've talked to Dr. Ely about that, is they specifically changed that rule to change how many people are being counted as COVID deaths. You mentioned willful misconduct. That is always, it seems to be, the sticking point. But it has to be willful misconduct. I mean, you literally couldn't make this many mistakes by accident. But how do you then prove that willful misconduct?
Right. Yeah, so that is the hard part, and that's where the grand jury comes into this equation. Willful misconduct is they're actually violating federal law, period. If they have missed the deadlines for publishing changes that should have been issued in the Federal Registry, and those items were not included in the Federal Registry, yet they changed the items within their jurisdictional domain, that's a violation of federal law. It's got nothing to do with willful misconduct. The willful misconduct side of the equation is for vaccine and pharmacological products where there is the potential for harm that is not disclosed. But we're making a case that these agencies have violated federal law today and should be held accountable today.
Well, that would be nice to see some people held accountable. That is such a rare thing when it comes to government. Just looking back at some of the numbers that we know were exploited, number one, the number of cases. The PCR test was counting flu as COVID-19. They were overly sensitized. They were running 43 cycles rather than what it should have been, about 25, which ended up showing false positives as high as 97%, maybe 93. But even 93% is really untenable and inexcusable that these PCR tests had that many false positives. Here in Oregon, they counted presumed cases as positive cases. If one person tested positive, they then tallied up everyone who that person had contact with in the last 14 days and counted them as positive cases as well. So that's clearly going to explode the numbers. active cases were also jerry-rigged because they continue to count you for a full 60 days as an active case after the date of your positive test, regardless of when you recovered. They inflated the number of deaths, as you mentioned. The number of deaths attributed to COVID were actually only 4% and were exclusively due to COVID. The other 96% of those deaths were with COVID, such as heart disease, diabetes, et cetera, and an average of more than four comorbidities. I mean, they were literally counting people who were dying in car crashes as COVID deaths. All of this was to overinflate the numbers and then use the fearmonger people to create the atmosphere needed to ram through the vaccines and trick people into thinking they needed it. Dennis, if some corporation did in their financial statements what the government did, where they claimed they had 100,000 daily customers but only had 4,000, what would happen to that company? Do you think there'd be some kind of punishment?
Oh yeah. There would be litigation coming out of every corner of, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get some momentum to get other jurisdictions, to get other senators and representatives involved, to have them sign up, submit a grand jury request. They can use ours as a template. They can make their own. They can modify ours as they please, anything that they think is appropriate. And the pro-vaccine side of the fence is really interesting because there are 4.5 million deaths worldwide and about 204 million recoveries worldwide. Those recoveries aren't due to vaccine. Those are recoveries because, like you say, of the eight people I was at the birthday party with, seven of them never got COVID but were counted as COVID cases.
Right.
Now that they're walking around in with natural immunity, they appear to be recovered, and indeed they are recovered, or they never got sick or whatever. But this dispels the entire concept of an emergency. So then you have to ask, why the heavy metal on the emergency foot pedal?
Yes,
why are we
yes.
driving emergency yes, with such yes. fervor?
Yep, exactly right. So if this grand jury doesn't work, what next then?
Well, we can always submit. There are several district offices. We could submit this grand jury request to several offices. We've done it to one here in the Medford office for the U.S., for the attorney for the United States of America. We can do it in other offices. We'll try and figure out. This is a great PR opportunity for us to say, wait, we've got questions. Let's say that our allegations all are for naught. Nobody really violated anything on purpose. It was just an accident here and an accident there. Well, then by golly, somebody ought to investigate, and we ought to tighten up the regulatory screening that we have for the government impact and how they misconstrue data and harm people.
Right, right.
I mean, we're talking about harming children and adults.
Absolutely. And all of the accidents just happen to inflate the numbers. So, Dennis, good luck with this grand jury investigation. We're going to definitely keep our eyes on this. Thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. It's great to be with you guys. The real interesting question is, if the 90%, the 93% you mentioned weren't there, would people be scared of school closings or school openings this fall? Would they really be keeping their children back at home or be afraid to go to the grocery store and pick over the same golden apples that the other guy was looking at?
I don't think so. I think it's all about instilling fear in people to elicit a response. Dennis, thanks again.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to welcome now Patty Milne. She is a former state legislator and county commissioner for Marion County and was the most truly reliable source that we had for good information about Oregon's own Obamacare structure, the CCO model, Coordinated Care Organizations. Patty, it is great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back and talking with you, Mark. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a few years, but just to refresh people's memories, the CCO model was pushed through because it was promised that it would save people, and especially the state, money. So to save money, it was going to be better organized, coordinating care among various care entities, the doctors, specialists, dentists, home care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. and set up an umbrella organization to oversee all of that. That's the CCO, the Coordinated Care Organization, because nothing solves government inefficiency and waste like putting in another layer of government on top of what is already inefficient and wasteful. It also put in layers of people between you and your doctor, assistants, and navigators, and it shifted care. Doctors wouldn't be calling the shots. Bureaucrats would now get involved in care decisions, all of whom would be eligible for state pay and state pensions for the 20-plus years of retirement. It also created a monopoly within their districts. To do so, the legislation specifically waived antitrust law so CCOs could be operated as monopoly within their given districts. Most damaging, in my opinion, it put in a global budget where all funds from all sources were dumped and stirred around so you couldn't see how money intended for one patient actually got to that patient. It's also, and it's been a while since we've talked about this, so I'm kind of shooting from memory here. Did I miss any key issues in that brief summary?
No, you've got that down just great. Your memory's good, and boy, the reminder though, it's heartbreaking to see what has happened because,
yes,
as you pointed out, the purpose was, and what I experienced in my experience as a state legislator and as a county commissioner, we want better health. We all want better health for ourselves and as elected officials and community servants. We want everyone to have better health. And that was the promise with both Obamacare and then, of course, with the creation of the CCOs, which did come out of all that was mixed together and part of what the far left was trying to implement in healthcare. So everyone thought, oh, it sounds great. Yeah, we're going to have better healthcare and it's going to cost less. And, you know, all these people who don't have healthcare, and there are many, many who don't and many who should. Everyone should be able to get healthcare they need. But so as a quick reminder, too, the thing, though, that really, there were a lot of discussions back in the early 90s. Let me go back to that. And looking at options, I mean, it's part of what you do as a legislator and people working on policy. So I did, as you said, got involved in that. And an area that I was particularly interested in was better health care for young children of working poor families. And so ironically, I did work on that piece of legislation and it was passed overwhelmingly in the legislature. And that was great. And it took a lot of effort. And it was really something that we all felt good and had some pride in passing. What also was happening, as you pointed out, there were also these discussions about these coordinated care organizations. And all of that was part of the mix that was going on with, and I'll just bluntly say, the far left. This idea that socialized medicine is going to provide good health care and savings to everyone, particularly the government, it's never been proven to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Because rationed care, it brings everyone into health care, or that's the theory, because it doesn't even do that. But then everyone will get health care. Well, the problem is the care you get is so diminished.
Yes.
From what our wonderful modern medicine. It's amazing what modern medicine has brought, and it has saved lives, all these new discoveries, new medicines, et cetera, et cetera. So, but the problem is not everyone gets to benefit from all that wonderful new care and treatment that is out there, because the cost has so increased that, you know, many people who could benefit from modern medicine really aren't able to. And so that's the real dilemma. And I think, you know, that's part of what we're going to get into here.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the other things that was really changed in there, too, was privacy issues, and not necessarily,
yeah,
for the better. Your healthcare information could then be shared within that CCO without your knowledge or even your consent. I know that was one of the things that they had struggled with early on, but also, and far worse, in my opinion, they changed health privacy for children, where they were then treated as adults.
Yeah.
And this also led into another program that they were doing with school-based health centers. Some of these would be,
mm-hmm,
and are operated by Planned Parenthood staff. I mean, why did we need on-site health centers when for decades parents took their kids in for medical appointments or an on-site school nurse dealt with emergencies? I mean, you could literally put your kid on the bus in the morning and not have a clue what happened to them. And the school had no obligation to tell you what happened to them. I mean, the school could take your daughter off to an abortion, and you'd never know it or even be told about it. Or if you asked and demanded to know about it, they had no they didn't have to tell you. I mean, it was shocking just even in that part. This was named the Oregon Healthcare Transformation, and there you go. I mean, that was a major transformation just in the privacy issues.
Well, one of the aspects of that you've touched on it, the issue of your child, boy or girl, being hauled off to or sat down and given medical treatment that you, the parent, have no idea your child is receiving. And the healthcare, it's not healthcare people often. I mean, it's a nurse. It's somebody who has, I don't know, taken a class perhaps. But that individual at the school really doesn't know anything either about your child's health. And so any treatment or advice or whatever the child is receiving could actually be very detrimental to that child's health. And that's a real tragedy,
oh,
too.
Absolutely.
But the other thing is this push that, well, the kids are at the school, so it's kind of a multi-service facility. Well, what has happened then to our education system? Mm-hmm. A child, especially young children, when, you know, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade, they're learning to read, they're learning to write, they're learning the basics, you know, math basics, et cetera, et cetera. And they're pulled out to go to the school nurse or whomever it is, or psychologist in many cases. And so they are pulled out of their classroom. They're missing that valuable educational aspect
they sure
of the day.
They sure are. Yeah.
That's a tragedy.
Yep.
And it shouldn't happen, because there are other times in the day that a need a child has, you know, physical, emotional, can be taken care of at another time, but not out of the classroom time.
No, it's not necessary. Okay, let's go and take a break there. We'll talk about the state of healthcare, looking back to where we were and now where we're headed. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Patty Milne. She's a longtime public servant, having served first in the Oregon House of Representatives before taking a job as one of three Marion County Commissioners, and she is now happily retired. And Patty, we were talking about the CCOs in the last segment, and one of the things that we had predicted way back in the day was that by instituting these CCOs and this grand healthcare transformation of Oregon, and of course the bigger umbrella, Obamacare, was that by giving the government control over your health care, you were giving them control over your life. And we are definitely seeing that now, where they have shut down businesses, shut down churches, shut down freedom of speech, actively working with social media to hide anybody that's telling the truth about these COVID vaccines or about COVID itself. I mean, it is just amazing. And, you know, we predicted it. That was back in 2012 that we were saying that. And here we are.
Here we are, and unfortunately, a lot of people, they just want to get on with their life and, you know, be a good citizen, and they think that following the dictates of the political elite is going to get them there. You know, one of the things that I know I'm using this word, it's tragic, and it's how I feel about all this. But one of the things about the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, or whatever they called it, and then the community care organizations, is your personal doctor was taken away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is because of trying to, well, where we are now, that the state is running hospitals, the ability for hospitals to expand or create a new one, doctors no longer having their office on Main Street, and you and your family go there for everything, and the doctor knew you and your family. Now you go to the doctor in some big healthcare organization, and it's sort of this parade of rotating doctors, and you're lucky to get a doctor because you're likely to get a physician assistant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not putting down people who are physician assistants. I'm just commenting on the nature of things. And then they seem more concerned about filling out their computer, so they make sure that they've dotted their I's and crossed their T's, and you're kind of waiting for a physical exam, and it doesn't happen unless you make an appointment for something specific a month later. So that's a part of how healthcare the delivery of healthcare has diminished greatly, in spite of the fact that we have all this great modern technology, but most people aren't benefiting from it. So now you don't have the local doctor who owns his own office, maybe not owns the property, but it's his business. He's a small business, or she, a small business person. They have their patients, and they know the people, and they know your health history. Now you go into the doctor, and they say, well, okay, what about this? Well, it happened, 10 years ago, but it should be in my record. Well, no, that's when this hospital was a part of this other organization, and when we changed ownership, all the records were lost.
Yeah.
Oh, my. So this person seeing you, and they're trying to fill out their computer, and you hardly get eye contact with them.
Just to look back over the last almost 10 years now since this was put in, it's really been more about the thriving bureaucracy rather than the thriving healthcare industry. I can't say that healthcare has improved, but the bureaucracy sure has gotten bigger. And as you said, there's a lot of decisions now that have to be okayed by bureaucrats. And in fact, we ran into that personally. Back in the day, one of the big discussion points was these death panels. And those are real. Mm-hmm. In fact, we ran into that personally. My father-in-law went into the hospital, needed some good care for a few days, and the doctors, I was dealing with two different doctors because we were there for so long, and both of them said, look, if it was up to me, he'd be staying here for a few days. But we can't make that call anymore. It all has to go through the administrator. And because he was shoved out back to a care facility where he was not getting good care, he ended up passing away a month later because he just went into a downward spiral and kept going and couldn't get out of it. And if he had just stayed there a few days, I'm convinced that he would have lived another couple of years because at that point, he was relatively healthy. But it was the infusion of bureaucracy into the healthcare system where it doesn't belong, where people are making decisions who don't have medical degrees. That, I think, is the real tragedy of this healthcare transformation.
It is. And then, too, that insurance, and again, I'm not knocking any one person in the insurance business. We need insurance. We need health insurance, just like we need car insurance. But the decisions are being made even above the your local insurance agent. There are so many wonderful routine procedures now, like cataract surgery, as an example. Well, people, they know their doctor's telling them, yeah, you're getting close to needing that surgery. Well, when can I get it? When can I get it so I can see better and I can stop the adverse effects of the cataract? Well, the insurance says you can't have this procedure until next year. Well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Can I just pay for it right now? No. You have to wait for the insurance to approve it. And as you've commented on, all these decisions are being made by a bureaucracy that does not include the people who really understand the time that's appropriate for someone to have the procedure.
It
really has nothing to do with age, although it's more associated, that particular procedure, to getting older. But it happens at various times for various people.
Well, and I'm glad you raised that point, because that was something that I had forgotten, was that at the time that he was in the hospital, speaking of our father-in-law, he was doubly insured. He had both Medicare, but he was also privately insured, and he had the cash that if they would just let him stay, he could have paid for it out of pocket, and they refused to let him do that.
Yeah, well, and health savings accounts, medical savings account, whatever the current term is yes. So a person can go to, for whatever it is, and as in your case, and say, well, I have this health savings account. Now, most people are able to use those still, but I fear that those accounts are going to be taken from us.
Yeah. If the government can't control it, I think it's a fair guess that they're not going to allow it. That's for sure. Okay, let's go and take a break. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Patty Milne, looking at the way things are in our healthcare system. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now with Patty Milne. She's a former state representative and later a Marion County commissioner who served during the Obamacare rollout and Oregon's own version of Obamacare, grandly called the Oregon Healthcare Transformation, although better called, more aptly called, Oregon's Healthcare Mutation. So, Petty, in the time that I have left, I mean, one of the things that this was sold to Republicans, and there were a lot of Republicans that voted for this when it came out, one of the things that they were told was that, oh, it's going to save us money. And that's why they passed it, was because it would save money. Looking back, has there been any savings of any money in all of this?
Well, not to my knowledge, Mark. And as we're discussing here, when you look at the bureaucracy, how it's grown, the processes to get things to happen, hospitals needing state approval, they've cut their staff because their budgets have been decimated. They're not getting the charitable contributions. You know, their founders' societies are not able to support them like they used to. Your local community hospital have relied a lot on the local support from the community, people willing to help buy the new neonatal monitor or whatever the case may be. And so money's tight everywhere. And so they've had to eliminate beds. They can't afford to staff them. And now with the pandemic, that's been the problem has increased substantially.
Yes.
And then to get to hire people back, you don't have people who are ready yet to come into the hospitals or the clinics and provide the care that's needed. And then the bureaucracy is just holding everything back from happening. Government cannot work at the pace that private industry can. It never will be able to do that. And that's a big part of the problem. We've handed over our entire healthcare system to government and to the bureaucratic mess that goes along with it. And you can be told it's going to save money. I don't know anywhere where government has ever saved money.
No.
Ever.
No, I don't think so. In fact, we've got now a dearth, as you mentioned, of Oregon, of hospital beds here in Oregon. Oregon Catalyst has been rated as the nation's worst hospital capacity per capita. And yet we've spent billions of dollars supposedly transforming our healthcare. I mean, how did that happen that we have gone to dead last after, despite the billions of dollars?
Well, it's kind of like our education system. It's totally run by unions and by people with big money. And that's what has happened. So it's out of the local control no longer exists in healthcare. And it's not going to come back until people really start fighting to get it back. In the midst of a pandemic, I'm not sure, except people are saying, no, I'm not getting the vaccine. And they have good reason to. I have, you know, immunity. And so why should I? But we're thrown into groups of people. Well, you're not vaccinated. So, you know, you're a part of the problem now. And that's not really the case.
No,
but
it absolutely is not the case, because there are, and Buck Sexton said this, I've seen it at other places as well, there are over 200 million Americans who are vaccinated, and daily cases right now are 300% higher than they were a year ago when there were zero people vaccinated. So the vaccines are not solving things. The vaccines were actually, when you look through their original application statements, they were not designed to prevent the spread of the disease. They were not designed to prevent infection. And yet somehow they were able to get the label of vaccine. And you had mentioned earlier about the problem with staffing. I mean, imagine if 20% of Oregon's doctors and nurses say, I don't want the vaccine. There's no reason for me to have that vaccine because I have immunity. I did this job back when there was no vaccine. You can't force me to have it now. There are certainly a number of reasons why you should not be getting that vaccine. And now you may have and of course with the mandates, now they're saying they have to get it, but you know, 10 or 20%, maybe even higher of the healthcare system suddenly walks away. Imagine the mess that's going to make.
But, well, it really is. And now you have people really fighting back for their own health safety. People who've had COVID, now they have their natural immunity, and they're still being thrown into the bag of the bad guys who are part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And so this current pandemic, I think, really reveals a lot about why our healthcare system is failing. And maybe more people, because of this pandemic, will start to say, wait a minute, I don't have any control over my health care. What does this mean to my freedom on other things, other aspects of life? And so in a bizarre sort of way, this might help wake people up to what has happened otherwise in our healthcare system.
Oh, I would certainly hope so. And you're right. I see this as the gateway to more control. It is, by obeying and getting the vaccines, it is not going to give you your freedom back or open up more freedoms or restore freedoms. This is the opening salvo in taking away freedoms. And all of this for a virus that has a 99.8% recovery rate, if you get it. And there are many things you can do to prevent yourself from getting it. And if you do, there are an enormous number of things you can do to rid yourself of it. Dr. Peter McCullough and others have all said that COVID-19 is the most treatable respiratory virus in history if you treat it early. And yet so much of the treatment has been to not treat it, according to government officials, don't treat it until it's too late. And then you're into the real pandemic here.
And that goes to part of what I think is really an awful aspect of this. Do these bureaucrats really want people to get well? And do we want to get rid of this pandemic? Or do they care about any of these individuals who, when they say, well, until you have symptoms, don't bother coming. Until you have symptoms, you can't get tested. Wait a minute. What?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just exposed. Not me personally. But people will say, well, I was exposed or I was concerned about it, but I was told I can't get the test unless I have a symptom.
Yeah.
Well, you can have it. It's just crazy. But I really hear, too, and I'm concerned, as you are, that this takeover of our bodies, our lives, is only going to get worse unless more people start to stand up and say, wait a minute, I'm not getting vaccinated because you said I have to. I might get vaccinated because I think it's in my best interest. But that's also part of what's bad about the bureaucracy and these powers to be. They won't share accurate information.
No.
They will only share what they want to share if it's pulled out of them. And therefore, the general population is left in the dark. And how do you know how to make the best decision for yourself when you don't have access to good information?
You're right. And that is such a great point. They are purposefully clouding the information. Patty, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. We'd love to have you back on sometime. Thank you so much for your time today.
I'd love to. Thanks.
On today's show page on iSpyRadio.com, you'll find some important links. That story about India prescribing ivermectin and had a greater than 99% drop in active COVID cases. The Idaho doctor is seeing a 20-fold increase of cancer this year. A press release about the grand jury, including some supporting documents, and tons more. There's also a story from back in 2012 where the UK was incentivizing doctors and hospitals to put patients on a pathway to death. They were paid roughly $60 million. Do you think things have gotten better since then? I seem to recall doctors incentivized to put COVID as a cause of death. There's your willful misconduct. Check those out, share those, because as we say every week, the best information is you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.